from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A weekend of protests is scheduled around the U.S. as demands for an end to police violence continue to grow.
There's thousands of people in the street. There's going to be civil disobedience. There's going to be disruption. There's going to be a rise of a dual power, not this baloney of speaking truth to power, because power doesn't give a damn about truth, really.
The country has witnessed the most widespread and sustained demonstrations in decades. In the past week alone, major demonstrations and civil disobedience were reported in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Miami, Tampa, Houston, Austin, Chicago, Minneapolis, Tucson, Phoenix, Seattle, Sacramento, Berkeley, Oakland, Los Angeles, and dozens of other American cities. Thursday saw a walkout by congressional staffers and Capitol Police in Washington, D.C. Press TV's Colin Campbell reports.
Congressional staffers are now the latest protesters on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers and their aides are speaking out against the Michael Brown and Eric Garner grand jury decisions. The group held their hands up to identify with the Hands Up, Don't Shoot protest that has become symbolic of the nationwide movement.
We're gathered here today so that we can be the voice for the voiceless. Forgive us when we have failed to lift our voices for those who couldn't speak or breathe for themselves.
The protest comes on the heels of civil unrest in New York and other major cities in recent days, protesting the deaths of two African-American men by the hands of white cops. Students around the United States are staging die-ins to protest the deaths of two unarmed black men killed by white police officers as they debate the failed indictments in classrooms.
They didn't even think that it was worth going to trial and asking a few more questions. That's the problem with our society today.
In Chicago, city council members have proposed a ban on the use of chokeholds by police officers working in metropolitan areas. But students say more needs to be done.
Change can definitely happen. I feel like we just need the proper organization and determination to evoke that change. I don't know how long it's going to take, but I know that we can get there.
New York activists are demanding that the city take action after a grand jury declined to indict the officer involved in the chokehold death of Eric Garner. Pockets of demonstrators led mostly by college students also gathered in other parts of the country, including Charlotte, North Carolina, Denver, Colorado, and Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. New coalitions are being formed in light of recent deaths and failed indictments. Groups such as the Anti-Lynching Coalition says it plans to continue protesting. Thousands of protesters plan to descend on Washington on Saturday. Colin Campbell, Press TV, Washington.
Major protests are set for Saturday in cities around the country, including in the nation's capital, where family members of some of those killed by police have been gathered outside the Department of Justice all week, demanding action.
We are mothers here today, unified to say enough is enough. We want justice.
Until we all stand together and understand that it's not a black problem, it's not a white problem, it's not a Hispanic problem, it's not a poor people's problem, it is our problem.
We want accountability. We want judges fired. We want defense attorneys fired. We want prosecutors fired. We want police officers fired. If they're not going to do their job that we pay them to do, we want them out of office.
My son, Clinton Allen, my only son, was 25 years old. He was unarmed, and he was shot 7 times, and once in the back by an officer who had a history with using excessive force with the Dallas Police Department.
This has been incredibly powerful, and I've been shutting down traffic, and what I see is people thanking us, and people taking pictures, and people approving. People get it.
We'll have more on this next week, including a recap of some of the weekend's actions. In Italy, clashes broke out between police and protesters as hundreds of Italian workers, many dressed as Santa Claus, descended on the streets of Milan Friday. They were joined by thousands of other workers in over 50 cities nationwide, with strikes hitting hospitals, schools, and public transportation to demonstrate against labor market austerity reforms. Similar protests continue to rock the EU countries in the Mediterranean area from Spain to Greece. For its part, Spain's parliament approved a controversial bill placing major restrictions on the right to protest. The law requires government approval of all protests and rallies and makes all unauthorized public gatherings punishable by fines of up to $745,000. Opponents say the legislation violates the right to protest, limits freedom of expression, gives more power to police, and undermines democracy. The measure was fiercely criticized by opposition politicians and activist groups, with lawmakers using duct tape over their mouths as the parliament debated the bill. Spain has been hit with a wave of demonstrations and strikes over the past months against the government's austerity measures. Marcelo Sanchez is a Spanish journalist and political commentator. He spoke with Press TV about the legislation.
The legislators of the opposition at the Spanish parliament were using duct tape in their mouths, but others were using pesetas, which is the local currency of Spain, indicating and implying that the administration of Mariano Rajoy and the Partido Popular has been plagued with corruption and other situations that really the moral authority of Mariano Rajoy and his party at this moment, it's very difficult in order to legislate some type of gag order, as it was qualified. The official name of this legislation is the Public Security Law. It was approved with a majority of 181 votes against 141. But the reason of this is because the parliament is controlled by a conservative majority, and the Partido Popular, which is Mariano Rajoy party, controls most of the Senate, most of the Congress, and the truth is that Spaniards are not happy with this kind of law because they feel that this restricts the freedom of expression, the freedom of demonstrations, because the austerity measures, the cutbacks in healthcare and education, those things added with the unemployment rates sky high, those things trigger social protest, social upheaval, and sometimes they encircle the parliament with clashes with police. Since 2011, there was a difficult situation since the Partido Popular assumed the administration of Spain. All these austerity measures really make an impression on the Spanish people. And you have to also consider that Spain emerged from a right-wing dictatorship by Franco in 1970. So the memories of those repressions are still alive at this point. Now, back in 1992, there was similar legislation that was about 30,000 euros if somebody would take pictures of police agents or police operations, and if those endangered the lives of the police agents carrying those operations. But in any case, we've seen a straight of this type of legislation. Let's not forget that a few months ago there was some reference to the anti-riot police in Spain getting special training, special equipment, and this was in the wake of the Catalonian movement of independence. So we have to suspect that they are getting ready for something else. Now, the opposition party said that if they assume office, they would scrap such legislations, such as this gag law or something like this, that this was basically a repression of the freedom of expression.
As the UN Climate Change Conference in Lima, Peru was winding down Friday, negotiators were reportedly deadlocked. Although many characterized the talks as difficult, some remain optimistic that an agreement can be reached, that according to a UN expert at the talks. Representatives from almost 200 countries have been working towards a new global agreement to be reached in late 2015 in Paris to limit global temperature rises. Stephanie Kutrix asked the UN's Daniel Shepard for his impression of the talks.
The parties that are coming together to try to figure out how they go forward, take decisions on what the scope of the commitments made in the agreement that will be adopted in Paris will look like. They're discussing all of these factors. There are some long, closely held views by parties, but there seems to be a mood where parties want to move forward and reach an agreement here.
200 countries are trying to agree on this draft text for a deal to avoid dangerous global warming. Media has been reporting that the draft has sparked criticism. What are you hearing?
Well, the draft has a lot of elements that incorporate lots of options for going forward. Not everything pleases everybody, and there's a line, you know, that is often spoken, you know, if everybody's unhappy, then we must be going in the right direction. There's a feeling by a lot of people that the agreement is not going to produce enough action that is commensurate with dealing with the problem of climate change, but the actual commitments that governments put forward under this process is not going to deal with the problem or won't be sufficient. On the other hand, there's another view that says that this whole process will open a pathway so that countries can ramp up their obligations over the next few years and as we go forward. So there's a lot to be hopeful for here. It is a positive step if they come to an agreement, but we'll see what the nature of it is.
The U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation Wednesday imposing sanctions against Venezuelan government officials who Washington claims violated protesters' rights during demonstrations earlier this year. The Senate approved the measure on Monday. The House approval by voice vote sent it to the White House. President Obama has indicated that he would sign the legislation into law. The measure would deny visas and freeze assets of officials involved in what Washington called a crackdown on political opponents during 3 months of street violence in Caracas. Venezuelan officials have accused the opposition of plotting with Washington to topple the Venezuelan government. Across the region, there was support for Caracas and scorn for Washington. Telesur's Cody Weddle has more.
The regional integration organization ALBA has rejected U.S. threats of sanctions against Venezuela. The nine-country bloc issued a statement condemning the U.S. for the sanctions, calling them a violation of international law. In Caracas, former Honduran President Manuel Zelaya, along with dozens of intellectuals and representatives from Latin American social movements, also expressed their condemnation. Zelaya says that the recent actions by Washington are another attempt to undermine stability in the country. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro sent a reflective message to President Obama yesterday, urging him to respect Venezuela's sovereignty. In his letter, Maduro highlighted the resolve of the Venezuelan people and promised that Venezuela will no longer tolerate abusive foreign policy measures. Maduro also warned that sanctions will only worsen relations between the two countries.
And for more news from the region, we now go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Okay, so we got a lot to cover. Let's hit it.
Yeah, that clip that you played just earlier about international concern in relation to the revelations about the CIA's disgraceful torture program that was effectively covered up both by the U.S. government and by its corporate media that virtually act as propaganda media, you know, for the United States government. That has had a huge effect around the world and also in Latin America. Now, for example, the Ecuador government has expressed its concern about what these revelations mean for U.S. government policy.
Yeah, you know, these things must definitely reverberate through the region there, given the CIA's long involvement in training people to do exactly that and or directing it itself over the years, over decades.
Yeah, and perhaps something that gets lost in all the controversy is that the CIA's torture programs are just one relatively minor part of the overall U.S. government offensive intervening in the internal affairs of other countries.
And bloody record, you know, indeed, too.
Yes, while we were chatting online before we started the talking, and you mentioned the infiltration by the United States of hip hop artists in Cuba.
Right.
You know, and it just demonstrates that, and that's just one of so many programs, United States government programs funded by, probably unwittingly, by U.S. taxpayers intervening in the internal affairs of Cuba.
Right.
to destabilize the government. And that's a relatively benign example, as the torture revelations show.
Right.
So then, and then you had a much more overt intervention in the U.S. Congress when they passed this law. The law in authorizing blatant intervention in Venezuela's internal affairs? I think it's called the Law for the Defense of Human Rights and Civil Society in Venezuela.
Yeah, right. That's something they've always been very, very concerned with, huh?
And it's just, it's such a, in so many ways, such a cynical joke.
Is that now a course listing at the at WINSEC, the former School of the Americas or School of the Assassins?
Well, yeah, quite. I'm Roy Bourgeois and his colleagues in that very important website working on the School of the Americas to try and close it down, in effect. And they'll have a lot to say about that. And so if people are interested, they should check out the School of the Americas, the Anti-School of the Americas website.
Yeah, for people that don't know what we're talking about, the United States has been running, and I guess it's been in at Fort Benning now for years in Georgia, a school training people in Central and South America, Caribbean, among other places, but many from there, in how to disappear people, how to kidnap and torture people, and essentially how to suppress any sort of uprisings from, rebellion among the population against being super exploited by American corporations. And they've been very effective, and there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of bodies that are a consequence of that training.
Yeah, and the response of the Venezuelan government and its allied countries in the Bolivarian Alliance for the Americas has been to issue a communique in which they reject the U.S. government's interference in the internal affairs of Venezuela. And among the things that they say is, I'm reading it now, it says that it's surprising and immoral that Washington is trying to punish the citizens of a sovereign country under the banner of human rights, exactly when its own Senate's Intelligence Committee has just revealed the information on the shameful methods used by the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States, which include brutal torture and degrading treatment of suspects detained in an arbitrary way in illegal jails around the world, and when that is also the habitual practice of police violence against African Americans in the United States, end quote.
Right. Pretty clearly stated and extremely accurate, factually.
Well, yeah, and that's the image that the United States has, not just in countries that are opposed to U.S. policy in their respective regions, but even among allied countries.
Right.
So, it's something that people in the United States and their political representatives have got to really deal with and not just sweep under the carpet, as they always do.
Yeah, there's the question of accountability that's been raised repeatedly now by just about every significant official at the United Nations and its various appendages dealing with human rights. They're saying that, confessing isn't enough, that you need to identify, and they are identified, the perpetrators of these crimes, and they need to be prosecuted and brought to justice.
Right. Well, good luck with that in the United States.
We have noticed, though, from a number of officials that have been asked, that some of the people involved, very high officials, have restricted their travel to places where they won't face justice, where they aren't afraid to face justice.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how all that pans out over the next few months.
Yes, indeed.
But the prospects aren't great for any truly just resolution of the revelations that have just been made. And of course, one has to bear in mind that those revelations have been very, very watered down.
That's right, of course.
And not just in relation to the United States government responsibilities, but also in relation to the responsibilities of allied governments. For example, the governments of the United Kingdom.
Yep, or Latvia,
and
or Poland.
Huge tracts of that Senate report were redacted at the request of the British government.
Right, that's right.
So it's not just the United States, and this is something that I feel very strongly about, that when people are attacking the United States for government, for its hypocrisy and cynicism, and it should be very much borne in mind that the Europeans were the governments that taught the United States how to be cynical and how to be hypocritical. And the Europeans have a much worse record historically,
right,
in many ways,
for sure,
than the governments of the United States. So they've got nothing to feel morally superior about.
Well, actually, the record of the United States is the progeny of Europe in any event.
Sure. I know that's something that Frantz Fanon used to insist on, and Malcolm X as well.
Yep.
And they were dead right.
Yep, absolutely.
So anyway, I'm moving on to other stuff. The one of the big events, and there have been various conferences. There's been the Cuba CARICOM summit,
yeah,
in the region, which again reaffirmed the respect and admiration of the Caribbean island nations for Cuba's example. In so many fields, especially in the fields, obviously, of health and education.
Sure.
And then there's been they reaffirmed their commitment to cooperate in all kinds of ways, not just on health and education, but also in economic terms as well, which is very important in terms of the Caribbean's regional development.
Absolutely.
So then, apart from that, Don, there was also this Ibo-American summit that I think was held in, now I can't remember it, it wasn't in Veracruz. It was somewhere in some city in Mexico. And that's, and it's hard to know what to make of that. I mean, the Ibero-American summit is basically an occasion where Spain and Portugal at a high level get together with high level representation from the countries of Latin America.
The former colonies.
Right. Yeah. This year it was attended by Spain's new king. Philip the Sixth, Felipe the Sixth, something like that, as if it matters.
Yeah.
And it's hard to see what the relevance is of that Ibero-American summit. And it seems to be, at one point, it was quite important when Spain was a very important aid donor in terms of Latin America, but that's a long time past. Although here in Nicaragua, the government is always very complimentary about the importance of Spain's development cooperation program in Nicaragua, which helps very numerous disadvantaged communities here. For example, in Managua, the Spanish Development Cooperation Program has done a fantastic job assisting the Nicaraguan government to shut down what was one of the most notorious rubbish tips in Central America, the Acuilinca rubbish tip. And what they've done is that it's a very interesting program, actually. They've converted it into a recycling center.
What is a rubbish tip? A dump?
Yes, yeah, sorry, yeah,
yeah,
a dump.
Garbage dump, whatever, yeah.
A massive trash dump for all the trash from the metropolitan area of Managua.
Right.
And what the Spanish government has enabled the local communities there to do is to recover their dignity, and they're working now in a state-of-the-art recycling center. And the local communities have been rehoused. They've got a good education and health facilities thanks to the Nicaraguan government. And the Spanish government has funded that recycling center and the housing infrastructure. So that's a good example of the relevance of Spain's development cooperation program in the region.
It points to something, too. It points to something, too, because If you look at the objective conditions facing Spain and Portugal, their economies are completely, you know, they're being treated like countries of the South in the EU. And they actually would benefit strongly from having mutually constructive relations with the countries and the markets in Central and South America, and they work at an advantage in terms of language and somewhat because of the common history. And projects like this can actually operate to the benefit of Spain and Portugal as well, if you look at the Chinese model, for example. And yet that's not really pursued because of the control of the national governments in each case by powers that are not so inclined.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Spain's development cooperation in Nicaragua is that over the last few years, and there's been this very right-wing government under Prime Minister Rajoy, but they have deliberately and very purposefully continued the same development cooperation lines as their social democrat predecessors. And what you just said is the reason for that, right? Because although one may kind of look askance at the Ibero-American summit in terms of its relevance, what you said is probably the reason why those summits continue, because they're a space in which the old world former colonial powers can renegotiate with their relationship with the new world former colonies, which are now becoming global economic powerhouses, especially in the case of Brazil.
Right. Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, look, we've got the same dynamic that we've been talking about, you know, forever about what happens locally, that the economic, you know, the obvious economic benefits of integration outweigh the ideological contradictions that exist in a number of the countries there.
Right. And another interesting thing, a kind of slightly going off tack, is something else that I was very grateful to you for sending me the link to, mentioning some off-the-cuff remarks by Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, when she was on a recent visit to Chile. And in the headlines in the news reports that we've managed to locate on the web are that Lagarde visits Peru and Chile to engage with the region. And then within that report, you get the Christine Lagarde's take on what Latin America should be doing. And that's very important in terms of what we were just talking about, the Ibero-American summit and spaces in which Latin America and the Caribbean can renegotiate its relationship with global trade partners. And what Lagarde is arguing for is that the subheadline is Latin America should focus on policies to promote quality growth, more balanced, inclusive, sustainable, blah blah blah.
Right.
And what the code, what all these kind of public speeches are just code, aren't they? And if you look closely in the code for what they're really saying, what Lagarde is essentially saying to Latin America is, the IMF wants you to follow the path of corporate consumer capitalism.
Right.
And the giveaway is where she talks later on in her remarks about, let's see if I can find it, a spaghetti bowl. She talks about, Lagarde mentioned the proliferation of trade groupings and how it's created a spaghetti bowl of regimes and preferences whose aggregate benefits are unclear. And she says policymakers should reassess the current approach to trade. And what she's saying there is that she wants the regional integration initiatives to be homogenized and oriented towards corporate consumer capitalism arrangements under the tutelage, if you like, under the supervision of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and all those outdated Bretton Woods, US-dominated and European-dominated international financial structures.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.